Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries worldwide daily over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on quacks and quackery when we come back. You know, the Civil Rights Act of 1868 was enacted by Congress to be the citizen's policeman against police and government abuse. Randy Weaver was paid more than $1 million for the wrongful deaths of his wife and son. Rodney King was paid $3 million. An Army scientist won over $5 million for wrongs committed against him. And right now, the police in Los Angeles, California, are bracing for hundreds of civil rights lawsuits in the latest round of Rodney King-style police misconduct. Now, you know, we hear a lot through radio, TV, and the press when these sensational government-citizen confrontations are being acted out. But then we hear little or nothing about the government paying for these abuses under the Civil Rights Act of Title 42, Section 1983. What would you do if you were victimized by the FBI or the IRS or some other government agency who takes your property, arrests you, jails you, or beats you? Is there a remedy for these wrongs? Well, there are more than 14 million of these civil rights-style crimes committed by police and government officials every year. Now, whether you've been a victim or you think you may be a victim of government wrongdoing, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? It doesn't cost you anything, and it's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. And click on to the archives page. And you can download that free general law CD package if you're online directly in the privacy of your own home. Again, that's georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com. Either one. And then you can download that free general law CD package. All right, last week we were talking about this thing of murder by injection. I talked to you about cancer last week and how the cancer monopoly makes a lot of money. Now, if you go contrary to the prescribed agenda of the American Medical Association in treating your cancer, you would be called a quack. That's right, a quack. Somebody that practices quackery. And that's just the way life is. Now, this word quack actually comes from the dictionary. A quack is an ignorant pretender to medical or surgical skill. So the word fits. It's a correct word right from the dictionary. People who practice medicine without a license are called quacks. My grandmother was a quack. And my Aunt Bessie and Mrs. Birchfield and Mrs. Johnson. Well, I was raised in an era of quackery. Of course, you got to be an old man now to recognize that, but I got to tell you that, yeah, it was true. These old ladies, you know, when children got measles and mumps and whooping cough and, you know, whatever it was, it didn't make any difference, skinned your knees or whatever it was, they didn't take you to the pediatrician. You know, you got an earache or something like that. these old ladies, they had concoctions. God knows what was in these concoctions, but somehow we all survived, you know, just looking around at the old guys that are still alive today, you know. Somehow we all survived all of the quackery that was perpetrated upon us. Today, of course, modern American women take their children to specialists called pediatricians. And these pediatricians tell these young mothers how to raise their children. You know, everything from soup to nuts. If the kid's got an earache or the kid's got a sore throat or something like that. And then they've got vaccinations. My God, the 35 vaccinations by age 5. Now, along with this, we have things like autism and sudden infant death syndrome. When I was a kid, nobody ever heard those words. Never heard the word sudden infant death syndrome. Never occurred. Never heard the word autism. I didn't know what it was. It wasn't until 1940, I think it was 43, maybe 41, something like that, that some doctor somewhere came up with the word autism, autistic. And I don't know where SIDS came from, sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS. And then it came up at some point in time, and the American Medical Association labels these diseases. They have what they call the physician's desk reference, the physician's desk reference, the PDR. It sits on every doctor's desk. And when you come in and tell him what your symptoms are, he looks up those symptoms and then he says, oh, here it is, right here, a copyrighted trademark. You got cancer, rheumatism, arthritis, muscular dystrophy, Hansen's disease, whatever it is. And then they've got prescriptions for that. Now, these are not quacks. These are medical doctors. Your pediatrician, he's educated, he's licensed, he's bonded, he's insured, he's responsible. He's got a good bedside manner, and he's not a quack. Quacks are people who are untrained in medicine. These are people, that pretend that they have medical or surgical skill. Now, quackery is also equated with charlatanry, and and it's called, in the dictionary, it's called a potent quack. Quackery is a potent quack, long versed in human ills, who first insults the victim whom he kills. So quacks, then, are equated with people who kill victims. And the American Medical Association and the American Cancer Society and the National Institutes of Health, the CDC, the Food and Drug Administration, these government agencies, these private trade organizations, are there to protect you from these quacks practicing quackery. Isn't that special? I thought you'd like it. So, Eustace Mullins has a chapter here on quacks, on quackery. That's why I said I thought his book was mislabeled. You know, it says murder by injection. It would have been better titled murder by medical doctors, or murder by quacks, or, you know, something along that line. Because of the 10 chapters that are in here, it covers a plethora of medical history here in the United States. Can't speak for you people in Canada, but I suspect that you've got about the same thing cooking in Canada, in Australia, New Zealand, and England, France, and probably you people in Russia and Japan and South Korea too. But at least here in the United States, this is the way we deal with it. So if I describe for you what's going on here in the United States, I think you people out there in the rest of the world can just kind of sit back, kick back, put your feet up on the hammock, and listen up, and I think it'll just about fit you wherever you live. That's called quacks on quackery. Listen to this. The first significant figure in American medicine, according to Jeffrey Marks, was a theologian by the name of Cotton Mather. Mather was born in 1663, and he died in 1728. Cotton Mather was the son of Increase Mather, who was the president of Harvard University. And Cotton Mather wrote many theological books, but he also wrote a full-length medical work. It was called The Angel of Bethesda, on which he wrote from 1720 to 1724. His medical letters drew heavily on local Indian lore. He also pondered the mental factor in illness, noting that in the Bible, there is a scripture that says, "A cheerful heart does good like a medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones." Now, Mather seems to have been the first and the last theologian to be interested in the practice of American medicine. The next figure of importance in American medicine was Dr. Nathan Smith Davis. He was born in 1817. He died in 1904. After apprenticing under Dr. Daniel Clark in upstate New York, Davis moved to New York City in 1847. As early as 1845, he had demanded that the Medical Society of the State of New York correct the more flagrant abuses in medical education, insisting that the 4 months of instruction then in vogue in the 1840s be increased to a period of 6 months. Imagine that. On May 11, 1846, he convened a group of physicians in New York City to form the nucleus of the American Medical Association. The organization took on formal status the following year in Philadelphia on May 5, 1847. That's the official date that the American Medical Association came into being. So it was in Philadelphia on May 5, 1847, and the 100 delegates to the New York meeting had swelled to over 250 at Philadelphia. They soon formed state organizations in a number of states. Smith later moved to Chicago, where he joined the faculty of the Rush Medical School. In 1883, when the AMA founded its journal, he became the first editor, serving until 1889. Despite the good intentions of its founder, Dr. Davis, the AMA remained moribund for more than 50 years. In 1899, the organization took a giant step forward with the arrival of one Dr. George H. Simmons from Nebraska. Simmons, who throughout his life was known perhaps derisively as Doc, is now remembered as the preeminent American quack. Oh, wait a minute. Hang on here a second. Eustace Mullins calls this guy Dr. George H. Simmons. I'm going to underline that name. Who was president of the American Medical Association, referred to as Doc, as the preeminent American quack. Now, I wonder what he means by that. He was born in Moreton, England. Simmons immigrated to the United States in 1870. He settled in the Midwest, and he began his career as a journalist. And it's interesting that the two other dominant figures in 20th century American medicine, Dr. Morris Fishbein and Albert Lasker, also began their careers as journalists. Fishbein remained a journalist all of his life. Simmons became the editor of the Nebraska Farmer in Lincoln, Nebraska. Now, several years later, he decided to improve his finances by launching on a career of unparalleled medical quackery. Interestingly enough, the American Medical Association in 1868 had formally defined quackery as the sale or administration of drugs or treatments that are not approved by legally constituted medical authorities. I'm going to put a bracket around that so we can come back to it. Here's the way the American Medical Association defines this. The American Medical Association has formally defined quackery as the sale or the administration of drugs or treatments that are not approved by legally constituted medical authorities. So when your Aunt Bessie prescribes Listerine for your sore throat, she's a medical quack. You know, that's just the way life is. When your grandmother puts Vicks Vapor Rub on your chest because you've got a cold, that's medical quackery. Think about it. It's the sale or the administration of drugs or treatments. Vicks Vapor Rub is a drug. Maybe it's an over-the-counter drug, but you know, there's all kinds of drugs. Aspirin's a drug. And it's being prescribed as a treatment, and they're not approved by legally constituted medical authorities. I mean, when the hell did your Aunt Bessie become a legally constituted medical authority to make these kinds of treatments, prescriptions? Huh? Come on. Now, that's a pretty broad brush to paint Aunt Bessie and Mrs. Johnson and Mrs. Birchfield with. I thought that's a pretty broad brush. So I thought I'd bring it to your attention. Okay? Once more now, so that you understand what a quack is. It's someone who sells or administers drugs or treatments. Drugs or treatments that are not approved by legally constituted medical authorities. Simmons ignored this requirement. No one has ever been able to determine that he had studied anywhere to qualify for a medical degree. Nevertheless, he began to advertise that he was a licensed, let's get a strange word here, I can't pronounce, licensed of the Rotunda Hospital of Dublin. So let's underline that. My wife's going to get after me here. She'll look at this book and she'll say, oh my God, you've been at it again, putting all these marks and all these brackets in here. So he was a licensed doctor of the Rotunda Hospital of Dublin, referring presumably to Dublin, Ireland. In fact, Dublin Hospital had never issued any licenses, nor was it authorized to do so. Okay. So Mullins took a look at it, and he went to the Dublin Hospital and said, do you people ever issue licenses? No, never did. And so he says, see illustration number 2, a full page ad here. So Dr. Simmons was advertising in the Lincoln, Nebraska newspaper. And he's got a picture of his ad here. Took it right out of the newspaper archives over here. G.H. Simmons, M.D., specialist, devotes special attention to diseases of women. Now, this guy Simmons later became the president of the American Medical Association. I just wanted to point out, you know, quacks and quackery here. Looking at the history of the people who defined what quackery and quacks are. That's the American Medical Association. They did that in 1868. And so their first president over here is what? First president. Well, I don't know if he's a quack yet, but we do know that he's a liar. Because he didn't have a license, and it wasn't issued. If he did, it wasn't issued by the Rotunda Hospital of Dublin, Ireland. Now, no one ever bothered to raise the question as to why Simmons, who had supposedly arrived in the United States as a duly licensed physician, chose instead to practice journalism for many years. He also advertised that he had spent a year and a half in the largest hospitals in London, although he refrained from making any claims as to what capacity, whether he was a patient in the hospital, or he was an orderly, or he was some other functionary in the hospital, he doesn't say. Years later, he obtained a diploma by mail from one of the nation's flourishing diploma mills, the Rush Medical College in Chicago, while maintaining a full-time medical practice in Lincoln, Nebraska. There is no record that he ever set foot on the campus of Rush Medical College prior to obtaining his degree. His protege, Morris Fishbein, also attended Rush Medical College. There was some question as to whether Fishbein ever actually graduated. Years later, in his time of influence, he became a professor there, specializing in teaching the public relations aspects of medicine. Now, Morris Fishbein, now remember, took over the American Medical Association around 1900. All right, so our first president of the American Medical Association was, by all of the definitions laid down by the American Medical Association, was a quack. We haven't gotten to Fishbein yet. But the first one here, this guy named Dr. George H. Simmons, was a quack. Isn't that special? Now, in their definitive work, The Story of Medicine America, an exhaustive and detailed compilation, the authors Jeffrey Marks and William K. Beatty make no mention of either Simmons or Fishbein, seemingly a glaring omission, as they are the two most notorious practitioners in our medical history. Apparently realizing that these two men were the two most famous quacks in medical history, the authors prudently decided to ignore them. So when you get into the medical literature and go back to the beginnings of the American Medical Association, this fellow, Eustace Mullins, goes back to 1845 and says, okay, let's take a look at the beginnings of the institution historically. Who incorporated it? Where was it incorporated? Who were the people and what were the histories of the people who were the prime movers of this thing called allopathic medicine in America? But the people who were commissioned by the American Medical Association, that's Jeffrey Marks and William K. Beatty, when they wrote The Story of Medicine in America, well, you'd think, now this is the history of American medicine, isn't it? They don't mention the first two guys in the program, Simmons and Fishbein. Now, isn't that something? Okay. In Who's Who, Simmons notes that he practiced medicine in Lincoln, Nebraska from 1884 to 1899. He lists his degree as LM, Dublin, 1884. Now, this raises further questions. Remember, Simmons had immigrated to the United States in 1870. He remained continuously in Lincoln, Nebraska from 1870 to 1899 when he went to Chicago. Now, for some reason, he didn't list the mail order diploma from the Rush Medical College in Who's Who listing in the 1936 edition. Now, he had listed it in the 1922 edition as receiving his diploma in 1892. Here again, no one later raised the question of his educational record, which showed that he only began his medical education in Dublin after he had come to the United States. So Doc Simmons' advertisements in Lincoln, Nebraska, which we have reproduced here, and it's on page 17, employed a standard phraseology of the time. It says, quote, a limited number of lady patients can be accommodated at my residence, unquote. That statement, a limited number of lady patients can be accommodated at my residence, was a coded notification that he was engaged in the practice of abortion. He also operated a beauty and massage parlor on the premises as part of a Lincoln Institute, of which he was apparently the only official. His advertisements also identified him as a homeopathic physician. Although he would soon embark upon a career with the American Medical Association to destroy the profession of homeopathy in the United States, his advertisements announced that he treats all medical and surgical diseases of women. Having learned about the American Medical Association, Simmons, always in search of more status, formed a Nebraska chapter of the American Medical Association. It was called the Nebraska Medical Association, and his talents as an organizer came to the attention of the Chicago headquarters, and he was summoned to take over the editorship of the Journal of the AMA. Thus, Doc Simmons came to the AMA not as a physician, but as a journalist. He found that the AMA was drifting along with no one capable of implementing a national policy. The situation was made to order for a man of his capacities and drive. He soon named himself as the secretary and general manager of the American Medical Association, launching the organization on its dictatorial and self-aggrandizing policies, which it has maintained from that day to this. All monies accruing to the AMA passed through Simmons' hands, and he personally supervised every detail of the operations of the AMA. And he soon found an able and willing lieutenant in a man who had formerly served as a secretary of the Kentucky State Board of Health. He seems to have been a man after Simmons' own heart, because he had arrested after examiners, or he had been arrested, rather, after examiners found a shortage of some $62,000 in his accounts. Now, as a member in good standing of the state bureaucracy of Kentucky, he managed to obtain an official pardon from the governor of Kentucky, with the gentle admonition that it might be best for him to settle elsewhere. So Chicago was only a short train ride away, where he found that Simmons was overwhelmed by his credentials. This gentleman, his name is Dr. E.E. Hyde, died in 1912 from leukemia. Now, this proved to be a very fortuitous circumstance for another journalist waiting in the wings. His name was Dr. Morris Fishbein. So let's underline Dr. Morris Fishbein here. Fishbein had apparently completed his studies at Rush Medical College, but he had not yet been awarded his diploma. In any case, Fishbein did not want to become a doctor. He had served as an intern at Durand Hospital for a few months, but he was unwilling to comply with the then regulations requiring a 2-year internship in an accredited hospital. He was seriously considering a career as a circus acrobat and had been working part-time as an extra in an opera company. He had also learned of a possible opening at the AMA and had been doing some part-time writing there during Dr. Hyde's terminal illness. Simmons had also found Fishbein to be a man after his own heart. When Dr. Hyde died, Simmons at once offered the youth a very handsome starting salary of $100 a month, a very high figure for 1913, and Fishbein found a home at the American Medical Association, which he did not leave until 1949, when Fishbein was literally kicked out of the organization. Now, with the advent of Fishbein, the American Medical Association was now firmly in the hands of the nation's two most aggressive quacks, Simmons, who had practiced medicine for years, unembarrassed by the fact that he had no medical degree which would hold up under the light of day, and Morris Fishbein, who admitted under oath in 1938 that he had never practiced medicine a single day of his life, because Doc Simmons, as he was genially known, had never shown any motivation in his career except greed, he soon realized that the enormous power of which the AMA was capable had in effect launched him into a gold mine. And he was not slow to request certain considerations in return for the favor or the goodwill of the AMA. Now, first and foremost was the seal of approval for new products, since the AMA early on, had virtually no laboratory, testing equipment, or research staff. The seal of approval was obtained by Green Research. I like that term, Mullins. It's called Green Research. That is, the laborious determination of how much the supplicant could afford to pay and how much it might be worth to him. At first, some pharmaceutical manufacturers resented this arrangement, and they refused to pay. The leader of this opposition was one Dr. Wallace C. Abbott, who had founded Abbott Laboratories in 1900. Simmons met Abbott head-on by refusing to approve a single product of the Abbott Laboratories, no matter how many were submitted. And this standoff continued for some time until one morning, Doc Simmons was visibly shaken to see Dr. Abbott towering over him in his office. "Well, sir," he stammered, "just what can I do for you?" Simmons asked. Abbott responded, "I just came down to hear from you personally," Dr. Abbott replied. "Why not one of my products has ever been approved by the American Medical Association?" Simmons responded, "Well, that's not really my department, sir. But I'll be glad to check with our research department and find out what the problem is." Abbott responded by asking, "Is there any way I could speed up your inquiry?" Simmons was overjoyed. At last, the stubborn chemist was beginning to see things his way. "Well, I'll be glad to do whatever I can," he said. "Well, there is something you can do," Abbott said. "If you would be so good as to look over these documents, it might help you to make up your mind." So Abbott spread out on Simmons' desk a number of papers put out on Doc Simmons' desk, and Simmons immediately realized that he was looking at a complete record of his career, carefully garnered by private detectives who had been hired by Dr. Abbott. There were the details, full details, of the so-called diplomas, records of sex charges brought against Simmons by former patients in Lincoln, Nebraska, and other titillating items, such as charges of medical negligence resulting in the deaths of patients. He knew that he had been trapped. "Well, all right," said Simmons, "just what is it that you want?" Then Abbott said, "Well, all I want is to have the AMA grant approval of my products," said Dr. Abbott. "Now, do you think that's possible?" Simmons said, "You've got it." And from that day forward, the products from Abbott Laboratories, which was still called Abbott Biologicals at that time, were rushed through the AMA process and marked approved. And Dr. Abbott never paid 1 cent for this special treatment. Now, isn't that just special? We're talking about quacks and quackery and the AMA in its earlier years. This is a book, remember, put out by Eustace Mullins called Murder by Injection. Hey, hang on a minute, I got to give you a reminder. That is, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org or georgegordon.com. Go to our archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there off your computer. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors and publications that we're endorsing and recommending are necessarily going to reciprocate by endorsing and recommending the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of the local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing a chapter on quacks and quackery from Murder by Injection by Eustace Mullins. If you'd like a copy of the book, go to bravenewbookstore.com. It's an easy one. bravenewbookstore.com in Austin, Texas. This is one of those books that's been censored by our government. Not formally, but kind of informally. I mean, you wouldn't go to the American Medical Association and say, gee, could you get me a copy of Murder by Injection, or the American Cancer Society. I mean, come on, let's grow up and get real. So if you're looking for a copy of one of these kinds of underground publications, you got to go to a source that deals in underground publications, and that's bravenewbookstore.com. All right, there's your first advertisement of the program. Now, we're talking about a fellow by the name of Simmons. Simmons was Dr. George H. Simmons from Nebraska. He was the first president, he called himself the secretary, I guess, secretary and something else here of the American Medical Association. He launched it on its career. He was a quack. Now, remember that the American Medical Association has a definition for quack. It's on page 15. And so far as I know to this day, as I speak, it is the sale or administration of drugs or treatments that are not approved by legally constituted medical authorities. And this guy Simmons was never a legally constituted medical authority. He never spent a day in college. He got a diploma from a diploma mill. Pure and simple. Now, he was practicing medicine back in the late 19th century before these licenses that doctors have today was a requirement. And there were several disciplines. You know, there was naturopaths and homeopaths and medical doctors and probably four or five others, just like there are today. And this doctor here, he specialized in women. I don't know exactly why he specialized in women. I don't know if he's a pervert or what, but he did, for whatever reason. And then he had some run-ins with the law. Some patients had died. He might have got sued a time or two. I don't know. It doesn't say here in the book. I don't have a complete list of all of his criminal history. But the guy wasn't following the protocols that are set down by the AMA. And remember, these protocols were set down in 1868. That was before he became the president. So he didn't meet the standards of the AMA when he was the president of the AMA. And finally, we're going to find that this is a pattern of the American Medical Association. They'll follow their own protocols. Eustace Mullins is the guy that dug all this out. And in here in the book, by the way, just in case you're a doctor and you're sitting there saying, why, this can't be true. I don't believe it. This guy is just a phony and a fraud and blah, blah, blah. Well, he's got an addenda here in the back of the book, you know, bringing up places and names and dates and times and so on. So I think it's not the best documented book that I've ever read. But Mullins is careful to go through and cite his sources so that you can go back and check up and find out, is this guy giving me the straight skinny or not? Now, if you want to check up on Dr. Simmons, so on, there are plenty of references here in the chapter Quacks on Quackery so that you can go do that. So you can find out who's lying. Is it the AMA that's lying to you, or is it Eustace Mullins? I'll leave it up to you. Now, my job in life isn't to persuade you that I'm right. I don't take that position at all. My position in life is I'm a reporter. This is an interesting story. I liked it when I read it, and I said, hey, how many people know this? And so I'm going to repeat the story. Now, remember, I'm not bulletproof. We do make mistakes. Once in a while, somebody calls up or they send me a letter, and they say, wait a minute, you made an error here or there. And that happens once in a while, but we try to be careful in what we present so that doesn't happen. It happens once in a while, but it's not very often. Not very often. And my boy Dirk does a pretty good job of checking this stuff out. Now we've got the resources. Remember, when you want to check things out, if you'll go online and do a Google search, you're going to be amazed at what you can find on the Internet, especially about the rich and famous. And there's a lot of material out there that other people have put out and put up on the net. So if somebody, you get out here and you say, well, I'm looking at quacks and quackery, and you want to do your own little expose here and find out, especially if you're a medical doctor or you're a medical worker or something like that, and you're wondering about some crazy lunatic who would question vaccination or question the American Medical Association, ask questions about, the president's health care program and so on. Here in America, we accept doctors better than we accept preachers. I mean, a doctor, is somebody to be looked up to. Preachers are a little bit, a little bit squirrely, especially after we got through, with Jim Baker and some of these evangelists or televangelists that have been ripping off the public and so on. But, by and large, when you're talking about a medical doctor, I mean, you're talking about a priest. You're talking about the high priests of medicine. And that's not very popular here in the United States. Now, going on, through the years, various versions of the Abbott-Simmons conflict were repeated. A whitewashed version appears in Tom Mahoney's book called Merchants of Life, which claims that Simmons objected to Dr. Abbott's commercialization of the medical profession and wished to teach him a lesson. The Council on Pharmacy and Chemistry not only refused to approve any of Abbott's drugs, but also turned down his requests to advertise in the Journal of the American Medical Association and later refused to print his letters of protest. Simmons then launched personal attacks on Dr. Abbott in the Journal in the issues of December 1907 and March of 1908. Simmons' pious claim that he did not wish to see Dr. Abbott commercializing the medical profession rings hollow. Abbott was manufacturing pharmaceutical products for sale. The rub was that he refused to pay the usual shakedown to Simmons. After the fight was settled, S. DeWitt Clough, Abbott's advertising manager, became a bridge-playing crony of Morris Fishbein. A spirited critic of the AMA during its Simmons-Fishbein period, Dr. Emanuel Josephson of New York wrote, "The methods which Simmons and his crew used in their battle for a monopoly of medical publications and of advertisements to the profession were often crude and illegitimate. The AMA has openly threatened firms that advertise in media other than their own journals with withdrawal of acceptance of their products." Dr. Josephson described Simmons' practices as conspiracy in restraint of trade and extortion. He further charged, again correctly, that almost every branch of the federal government active in the field of medicine was completely dominated by the American Medical Association, and this was borne out by the present writer, who cites many instances later of government agencies actively implementing the most horrendous cases of racketeering by the drug trust. So exhaustive were the controls set in place by Simmons that the president of the AMA, Dr. Nathan B. Van Etten, later filed a sworn affidavit in the New York District Court that he, as president of the AMA, had no authority to accept any money or enter into any contracts. All such deals were the province of the Chicago headquarters staff. It was later noted that AMA focuses on protecting physicians' incomes against government intrusion in the practice of medicine. I'm going to underline that. That's one of the most important statements in the book. It was later noted that the AMA focuses on the protecting of, that's the protection of, physician incomes against government intrusion in the practice of medicine. So the AMA is there to protect you doctors. So membership in the AMA makes all the sense in the world for you doctors out there, and I don't deny it. Hell, I understand participation in trade organizations. Makes all the sense in the world. And especially since you've got a monopoly. I mean, you know, you've got a monopoly on cancer, a monopoly on heart disease, a monopoly on prescriptions and prescribing. And then that's the purpose of the AMA. It is a trade organization of the medical doctors of America to protect their incomes. Well, now what does that say to the rest of us? Well, okay. Caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. Let's pay attention to reality. Doctors are entrepreneurs. They're out there selling product. Whether that product is good for you, whether that product makes sense for you, such as we talked about earlier here, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about injections and inoculations. If you take your kid into a doctor, he has you sign a release. He shoots your kid up, he later comes down with autism. You got no action against the doctor or the pharmaceutical company. None. You're the guy that's responsible, mom and dad. So let's wake up and smell the coffee here. See, most people out here in America, and I presume probably around the world, are legally incompetent, unable to make these kinds of legal decisions. You have no education in law, although the Creator, now this is God Almighty Himself, insisted as a matter of law that every individual on planet Earth have a degree in law, that you have a legal education. It is part of the Ten Commandments. It's a part of the laws of God Himself that every human being have a legal education. And it starts with the Ten Commandments. Now, of course, we're not going to have that. That's not going to happen. We've already preempted God and the Ten Commandments. Now, let's wake up and smell some coffee. So the average Joe Sixpack, who is governed by law, I mean just absolutely inundated by 2.5 million laws here in the United States, all of them emanating from our Congress and our legislatures and city councils and county commissioners now. We've got 2.5 million of these laws. We seem to love them. We are busily worshiping our gods, and we busily practice all of these laws, from buckling our seatbelts to writing our checks and getting driver's licenses and all the rest. We certainly wouldn't want to be quacks and practicing quackery. And so here we got this American Medical Association over here, headed by two quacks. That's their founders. It's a quack organization by their own definition. They take payoffs and shakedowns, and they do to this day. This isn't something that happened 100 years ago. This is the way this operation is run today. And here's what's genius about this whole operation. You see, they have enlisted the police powers of the state. This is where the Cosa Nostra and the Mafia have fallen down. See, the Cosa Nostra and the Mafia are operating as free enterprise institutions. They're just out here in the marketplace competing with all the rest of the drug dealers and loan sharks. But not the American Medical Association. Hell no, not the drug manufacturers. They go right to the government and have the laws made. And in fact, they write the laws and then take it into their local senator, representative, say, Bob, I'd like this law passed. Now get to it. And instead of Abbott going into the AMA and paying bribes, hell, they go into the FDA and they say, hey, just approve it. They control it. Now, that's the genius of this kind of criminal syndicate. They have the government, the A number one criminal institution in the world, government. They come out and they create the laws that they want to protect their medical monopoly and to monopolize that segment of the economy. God love them. I mean, these people are smart. You know, Al Capone was probably a nice guy, but, you know, Al Capone never had anything on the AMA, nothing on the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, these people are geniuses. The bankers out here are in control of the pharmaceuticals and the AMA. So the bankers are really at the top of the pyramid. I mean, you just take a look at the way this system has been set up. And Eustace Mullins is the guy that has uncovered it in one of his books. He's just one of about 10. One of them here called Murder by Injection is just replete with the expose on this medical monopoly and how the thing actually works. Now, if you're not interested in how it works, well, then, you know, let it pass and just go to the doctor, shut your mouth, roll up your sleeve, take the shot, and go about your business in life. And then when your kid comes down with autism or dies from SIDS or something else bad happens, you know, then don't sit there and criticize the system. The system is set up in such a way that it benefits a lot of people. I've often said there's no such thing as a bad law. I hear this constantly. People will complain about a law, and they say, this is bad law. Well, wait a minute. All laws are good laws. All laws are good laws for somebody. People don't sit down and take their time, effort, and energy to write up these laws and then go through the legislative process and all of the money that it takes to get them passed, you know, for no good reason. They're not dumb. Now, you may be sitting there, you know, like the average Democrat and say, well, but it isn't good for the majority. Well, most laws are not enacted for the majority. They're enacted for little special groups of people. For instance, in the year 2002, I believe it was, a representative by the name of Dick Armey, he was enlisted by somebody to slip a little piece of legislation, three or four lines, into a bill that had nothing to do with medicine or pharmaceuticals. And it's called a rider on a bill. And he slipped it in to the lawmaking process, which exempts pharmaceutical companies from suit by victims of inoculations. Now, there's 300 million people in the United States, and there are 18 major pharmaceutical companies in the world. Not all of the pharmaceutical companies in the world make inoculations. This law was not made for 300 million Americans. It was made for 18 pharmaceutical companies. They're the only beneficiaries. And the law specifically says you cannot sue them. If they kill you or injure you, you cannot sue them. Okay? Now, it benefited 18 people, 18 corporations, 18 institutions in the world. That's the only purpose for that law. God loved Dick Armey. He did his job. He did it well. Now, the fact that it's disadvantageous to 300 million people is irrelevant and immaterial. That's a good law. It was a good law for the 18 people or the 18 institutions that it was created for. And that law works perfectly for those 18 institutions. You can sit there and argue, piss and moan, jump up and down, paw the ground, bite the bushes, and complain until hell freezes over. But it's still a good law for those 18 corporations. And it was designed for those 18 corporations. It was not designed for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, whose kid has been injured by an inoculation or a vaccine, and now is suffering from autism or died from SIDS or something else. That law was not made for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife. And you may complain bitterly and say, but it's not good for the majority of Americans. And that's probably true. But that doesn't make it a bad law. Now wake up. Here, smell the coffee. That's a hell of a good law for the people that it was intended for. Was it debated on the floors of Congress? Hell no. It was slipped in the middle of the night and nobody knew it was there until they woke up one day and said, oh my God, we've passed this legislation. How is that possible? Well, hell, it goes on every day. In fact, your representatives, your lawmakers, don't even read the legislation that they're voting on. When the Patriot Act and Homeland Security bills were enacted, they were put out in such a hurry and passed within a week, you couldn't have physically sat down and read those 1,350 pages. Not that anybody wanted to anyway. But you couldn't have physically done it. And they don't. And they didn't. And they don't. And they won't. How do you like that? All right. So the AMA then focuses on the protection of physicians. It's a monopoly. It's a protection racket. And it's quackery run by professional quacks by their own definition. The book, Murder by Injection, Eustace Mullins. You get a copy from BraveNewBookstore.com. BraveNewBookstore.com. Hey, I got to give you a final reminder that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, our schedule, and archives. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, time's up. We got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.